Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and this is the Downtime Podcast, where I take you behind the scenes of downhill and enduro mountain biking and meet some of the characters involved in making this sport as great as it is. This episode is supported by PNW Components. I've had a PNW dropper post on my bike for a year and it's had exactly zero issues. Every time I push the lever, it's done what it should do, which is more than can be said for some of the other posts that I've used in the past. The Loam Lever Remote is a joy to use with a grippy, injection-moulded pad for your thumb, meaning you get grip on the lever even in the depths of a sloppy winter, and the oversized bearing means it doesn't get grunchy and hard to push. PNW have also just launched the Shifty Lever, which is essentially a loam lever to replace the thumb paddle on your high-end SRAM shifters, so check out those over on pnwcomponents.com. They've got a new version of their Rainier dropper that's available to pre-order now, and it's got a really simple adjustment system so that you can set it to the perfect length for you. They've also reduced the overall length of the post. I've got one on the way and that should mean that I can move from 150mm drop up to 170, which will give me even more room to move when things get a bit leery. You can check out what they have to offer over at pnwcomponents.com, and as a special treat for all you Downtime listeners, they're offering you 15% off during May. All you need to do is use the code PNWDOWNTIME, all lowercase, all one word, at the checkout. You can find the link and the code in the show notes for this episode over on downtimepodcast.com. Hopefully by now you'll have watched some of the live podcasts that I'm doing on my YouTube channel at youtube.com/downtime mountain bike podcast. You can either join us live and ask the guest your questions right there and then, or you can watch them on catch up whenever you like. So far, there are chats with Katie Winter, Nico Mullally, Elliot Jackson, Dakota Norton, Ben Plenger, Johnny Thompson and Cy Turner for you to head over and watch. The next episode will be with Coach to the Stars, Chris Kilmurray, aka Point One Athletic. That'll be taking place at 8 p.m. BST on Wednesday the 20th of May. So head over to youtube.com/downtime mountain bike podcast now, subscribe to the channel and set yourself a reminder to join us for a chat. To make sure you get your weekly fix of the audio version of the podcast, then head to downtimepodcast.com/subscribe, and there's links there to help subscribe on whatever platform is best for you. While you're at it, you should join our newsletter to receive our weekly weekend warm-up email for a few bits of interesting bike-related stuff come into your inbox every Friday. Merchandise sales are still closed, but if you want to help support the podcast during these challenging times, then you can still do that with a Share the Love donation via downtimepodcast.com/shop. Donations start from £5 and go towards keeping the podcast going and helping improve what I'm doing. Okay, on this week's episode, I'm going to be chatting bike design with Aaron Abrams and Adam Hammerman from PNW Components. These guys have got a lot of experience in the industry, working for brands like Specialized and Marin before getting together at PNW. We sat down to find out what goes on behind the scenes to bring us the amazing products that we get to ride. We chat about the difference between engineering and design, the stages that products go through before they get to us, and what happens when it goes wrong, and how something as simple as product finish can affect how it performs. This is an area that doesn't get spoken about that much, and I hope you enjoy finding out more. So, without further ado, here's Aaron and Adam. All right, we're welcoming two guests to the show today. First up, it's the owner of PNW Components, Aaron Kirsten. How's it going with you, Aaron?
Hey, not too bad, guys. How are you doing?
Yeah, really good, thanks.
Cool.
And next up, we've got PNW's Director of Design, Adam Hammerman. How's it going with you, Adam?
Hey, good to see you.
Good stuff. And you're not based in the PNW, are you? Is that right?
No, actually, my particular journey in the bike industry took me to Switzerland. And well, it's a little more complicated than that, but I'm an expat in Switzerland.
Fair enough. Just before we catch up with Aaron on the last year or so, just give us a brief overview then, Adam, of how you've got to where you are now. What's your career path been?
Sure, sounds good. So about 2011, I had graduated design school through an internship that I had not related to the bike industry. I met some contacts that were in the bike industry. And as I started looking for work, an opportunity came up to interview at Specialized Bicycles. I got the interview and originally was interviewing for a position as an equipment designer. So tools, pumps, et cetera. And that position got canceled. So they liked me enough to offer me an internship. As I said, I was fresh out of school, so they felt that was a good way for me to get my feet wet, and that went really well. So I'd say about 2012, I had started at Specialized. I was there for several years working on all sorts of stuff, as a designer, well, an industrial designer, everything from kids bikes to fitness bikes to mountain bikes, components, etc., water bottles. And then on a trip to Europe for Eurobike, I met a girl, and basically she's Swiss, and I knew Specialized had a Swiss development office, and I asked if I could be transferred. And that began a 3-year career designing e-bikes and e-bike accessories for Specialized.
Yeah, that's the e-bike office that's based out.
Exactly. Yeah. And then while I was there, Aaron and I, of course, have been keeping in touch all this time. And, you know, he was pushing to have me join him at his side. And I thought, what a great opportunity to work with a great friend and do some really cool stuff in a very different company culture and atmosphere. And I took it.
Excellent. So Aaron, yeah, let's catch up a little bit. So you came on the podcast in May last year, and we put out an episode then called Becoming a Mountain Bike Entrepreneur, which talked about where PNW came from and how you got to where you were then. But things have gone pretty well in the last year, yeah?
Yeah, it's been going well. That's crazy. That was less than a year. That feels like 5 years ago that we did this, but I guess time flies, right? So things have been going well. We've grown considerably actually and been able to reinvest into basically what the company needs, right? So everything down to, you know, obviously expanding our product line, but you'll notice, you know, I think the last time we talked, we had one, maybe two employees, but there's now 11 of us, which has been incredible to do. I mean, there's two parts to it, right? Like there's what the company needs and building out a team. Obviously, like Emily and I can't do everything. That became clear very quickly. But the other part is just like, this is a great crew. Like it's really fun working with everyone, interacting with everyone. We will, you know, keep things pretty lighthearted. So that's been awesome. So and especially, you know, as a fully remote team, it does take a special person for that to work. You know, you have to be okay with electronic communication. And, you know, we do face-to-face stuff. Obviously we are, a lot of the team is local, so we're able to meet up every once in a while, but especially with what's going on now with COVID, you know, you need people who you trust that are independent and able to take on projects and run with them, without needing, you know, a checklist of like, okay, here's what I want you to do today. Check off all these things. Like we don't have anyone like that. So that's been great. But yeah, we opened our own fulfillment center. That was a huge undertaking, and I give a ton of credit to Andrew Marshall, who's our chief operating officer, as well as Matt Van Dam, who is our warehouse manager. The two of them took this project, got all the software integrations going, negotiated all of our shipping rates down. The thing's running extremely well, and that's kind of a nerdy behind the scenes thing, but for me, that's a huge point of pride is the fact that we're able to get shipments out the door consistently and extremely fast, which sounds like a small thing, but man, we had so many problems with the various what are called 3PLs, third party logistics companies. So it became necessary and we did it. So I'm really happy about that. But yeah, I mean, we're up. I think our sales tripled since the period of time that we talked. So that's been tremendous. And, I think we've launched like 9 or 10 products since we chatted. So really expanding our product line outside of just dropper posts. It's been going really well. I'm happy. I mean, there's never a dull moment and never a time where you can kind of relax. Like I'm constantly anxious and stressed out because now, the stakes are higher. We have employees that we need to take care of and ensure we're doing everything we can, that everyone's paid and that we're able to do what we want. Right.
For sure.
But at the same time, it is extremely validating. I don't want to downplay that part.
Good stuff. How has your role changed in all of that then? Cause obviously you're going to have had to be less hands-on than you were, I suppose.
Yeah, you're right. It's changed in some interesting ways actually. And in ways that I didn't anticipate. So, I got to a point where I was spending a ton of time interacting with customers. So we were, you know, dropper posts are a pain in the ass, man. If I were to do this all over again, I think we'd go a different route because there's diameter you have to account for. There's how much travel you can fit. There's how the internals work. There's how you service these things. How do you troubleshoot them? There's a lot, right? So it's not like a grip where it's like, hey, this is a grip and you can put it on your handlebar and you pretty much know what you're in for, and they're all compatible. You know, it's not like that. It's a really complex product. So anyway, I was doing quite a bit of customer service. I was, you know, very deep in our shipping and logistics and doing all of our sales, trying to land, you know, online retailers and things like this, as well as dealers. So we now have a team taking care of that. So I'm now working on a much higher level of really digging through data, right? Like seeing what our sales trends are, what may have influenced something to drop. Should we put more focus there? Working with Emily and her marketing team to see what initiatives we have coming and make sure that lines up with what we actually have in stock or what, I don't know. Those are kind of lame examples, but it's more looking at things from a higher level. And making sure that the team has what they need to do a good job. I think I view myself as kind of like the person that can help alleviate issues and allow people to be doing their jobs better, I guess is the way I view myself. As opposed to like, again, like instead of just, barking marching orders, it's more working as a kind of like a floating team member to really help everyone out, is at least how I hope to be viewed.
Good stuff.
And then, you know, work, I still am the, you know, well, Adam is also doing this, but, you know, working directly with our factories. So, it's best to have as few lines of communication in just to keep things simple. So, you know, I'm everything down to like, you know, placing the, or paying for the orders and ensuring that things are coming on time and alleviating any sort of supply issues we may have. So that's still a big part of, I guess you could call that vendor relations. A big part of what I do as well. Yeah. And really, you know, like what's the future of the company? Like there's a million directions we can go. And that's something that really we're considering every single day is like, are we staying true to who we are and moving in a direction that we want to go? Because especially with product, man, you can go so many directions and it's not necessarily a good thing.
Yeah, totally. Well, we've obviously got two very experienced kind of product designers, developers on this chat. So we're going to focus on exactly that and find out a little bit about, I guess, what goes on behind the scenes in product and bike design and development that people often don't know about or don't know that happens. So yeah, where should we start with that, Adam? Maybe we can hand over to you and give us your thoughts on bike design and development and how that works for you.
So I think one of the biggest misconceptions in our industry from the rider point of view is actually just how complicated it is to make a line of bicycles happen. Even if you were to just take one bicycle model from one company and say you have your traditional all mountain trail bike, that bike may be offered in five or six sizes. And within those sizes, there may be four or five spec levels. And within all of those, there may be four or five paint schemes. That alone is a whole load of work that needs to be done, let alone all of the decisions that need to be made that result in the ideation of what that bike is, what role does it fill, how does it perform, how are we going to market it. It's a huge undertaking. And so what it really, I mean, starting out at one of the industry giants is one thing, but what it really gave me an appreciation for was these small brands that are creating really good bikes out there and really good parts for that matter is a labor of love. And it really does take a lot of effort and energy. And the bike industry, these big brands would be nothing without their honestly amazing suppliers on the other side of the world for the most part. And, it's a dance, and Aaron starting out as a product developer, was involved a lot in kind of the nuts and bolts of getting all those gears turning to make a product happen.
Very true. Very true. Yeah, it's a fun thing too, especially being on this side of things. So, you know, we're an aftermarket component brand, which is, you know, it's similar. The suppliers are the same, but the business is very different because we're able to interact directly with customers. as opposed to on the bike side, it's all OEM, so original equipment manufacturer, right? So that's where your sales channel, you're selling through either distributors or into dealers, and so those are your customers, which is a weird, well, weird's the wrong word. It's a very different way of looking at things, right? So you're obviously wanting to create something that the end user, so the customer buying it from a bicycle shop, for instance, something that they want, but you need to first get sign off from, you know, the dealer level, the distributor level, and then all the different layers up until that point, of, you know, the marketing teams and the sales reps and the sales managers and their teams. So yeah, it expands very quickly. And one thing, that also goes into play is like any component that's put on the bike, basically it has a 3x multiple at the retail level. So what I mean by that is like, let's say you put a part that is $10 onto a bike, it's going to basically increase the price of that bike by $30 by the time it's at the retail level. So I hear a lot of people online, you know, it's like, why is this bike so expensive? Why is it almost like a motorcycle? It's not, these companies aren't pocketing gigantic sums of cash. It's just because of the distribution channel that these bikes end up being really expensive. And that's where direct-to-consumer brands, you know, like YT, Canyon, CommonSol, these guys are able to, they're really starting to change how business is done, right? Like these bikes are a better value from a spec standpoint. It's because they sell direct. So I'm curious to see where that goes.
Yeah, it's a big change, right?
Yeah, it's a major change. Part of me, I'm really conflicted, to be totally honest. I love bicycle shops and the role that they play, because you're able to educate customers, you're able to provide a really high level of service. And when you're buying online, that's much harder to do. So, I mean, if you're an expert and you know exactly what you want, and all you're looking for is the best price, that's great. And you can assemble the bike yourself. Fantastic. So I love it from that standpoint, because prices, you know, there's a little bit of fat being cut out of the market, but at the same time, that's not a great model for everyone, if that makes sense. Like some people need a little bit of education from the sales floor. They need, you know, maybe they need the service contract to ensure the bike's working well and all of these things. So it's, I don't know. I'm curious to see where things go. Because I think, I don't know. I worry that if we go too far on the consumer direct side of things, there's going to be a lot more warranty claims. There's going to be a lot of people turned off by biking just because either they made the wrong choice of bike or it wasn't set up properly. And that's a major concern, I think, for a lot of brands.
Yeah, well, as bikes get more complicated over time, mm-hmm. they're even harder to get set up, right?
Oh my God. Yeah. Ugh, I get so, just on a side note, setting up suspension, like it's become to where it's too many options for me. I'm just like, I don't, you know what I mean? Like, I just want to get on the bike and have fun. My days as a product developer in the bike world, you know, are somewhat behind me. So it stresses me out getting back in that mindset of like, I have to optimize this bike to be absolutely performing at its best every single time I jump on it for that specific trail. And it's just, I don't know, it's a pain in the ass. I just want like one switch where I can just adjust rebound a little bit at this point is where I am.
Keep life simple.
Preload. Exactly. But, sorry. So jumping back into the product development, I mean, the bikes that I had the most fun developing were actually the low cost bikes, because those are so much more, difficult to make in some ways. I mean, obviously the engineering of a suspension frame, that's a massive undertaking, and I'm not an engineer, so I'm not even going to pretend. You know, I know what the best is for that. In terms of speccing the bike, let's say you're making, you know, a $5,000 mountain bike. There's only a few choices you have for a drivetrain, right? Like you're either going to be Shimano or SRAM, and you're going to choose basically one of two different spec levels. And those are your options. You know, if you go off with one of these side brands, it's a huge risk that's probably not going to be warranted at the retail floor. But on a bike that retails for maybe $1,000 or even $500, it's cutthroat. Like you have way more options, I guess you can say. And as long as you hit a few name brand staples that people are comfortable with, you know, like maybe the fork, you should hit a brand that someone's heard of, you know, whether it's RockShox or SR Sun Tour. People on the sales floor have heard of that, and a lot of customers have as well. And then maybe your rear derailleur, you need to keep it a name brand, as such as Shimano or SRAM. then you're good to go. But everything else is kind of open for interpretation, like what disc brakes you use. You could use a brand no one's heard of as long as it's a disc brake. Like that's a huge advantage for a bike that at that price point. What crank you use, man, if you can save $5 on a crank, that's going to have a almost a, you know, $15, $20 impact at the retail level. At those price points, that is a huge difference between bikes because it's very competitive. So that part I always found really, really enjoyable. And I think those bikes get overlooked, which is unfortunate because there's so much you can do that really brings value to the customer that puts a smile on their face. And that's awesome. Like I really enjoyed that aspect to it. Adam, on the frame side of things, like I remember when we worked together, I mean, you were literally modeling frames out of clay, or at least making modifications to the frame and actually sanding them down at these lower price point bikes. And I thought that was really, really cool because A, I had never seen anything like that outside of like a, you know, a video you see at like a car manufacturer. But also I think, again, I don't think a lot of people realize that's the level of detail that goes into a bike at that price point.
That's a really good point.
That was pretty cool.
I think, You said it right, how Spec Wars is huge in the value-based bike. And I think also it's a really great opportunity for I guess you could say, the styling part of the designer's job because mm-hmm. by and large, you have less stiffness targets, you have less weight targets. And what you want is a bike that has a look and feel that someone quickly draws their eye to on the shop floor. Make the shop floor sale and then make the parking lot sale and you're good to go. But yeah, you get a chance to try different silhouettes out, try some different shaping out that maybe on a, say something like a specialized tarmac or, you know, a Graham Counters bike, you would never get a chance to try. And that's ultimately why you probably saw me slaving away in the model shop is to get a silhouette, that is differentiated enough from the other bikes out there to look special and unique and give someone kind of a pride of ownership. They say, I want this bike. Hey, look at my bike. It's cool. It reflects my yeah. personality and my tastes.
Totally.
So is it fair to say then that there's a lot of effort that goes into not just the way a bike functions and not just, you know, the spec, the price point and all of that side of things. And obviously, you know, color schemes, what have you, but in the actual silhouette of the bike, is that something that people are focused on?
Yeah, I mean, sure. just quickly, one thing. I mean, the holy grail that really stood out in my mind is we were told, okay, if this bike was whatever, you know, 20 meters away, what, like, can you tell what brand it is? If you were to take all the logos off, can you tell what brand that is just by the silhouette of the frame? And if you've nailed that, then you have a bike that will do well in the market. In terms of, you know, being able to differentiate your brand. So that really stood out. And I mean, Adam, obviously this is your world, but I remember that and being like, oh gosh, that totally makes sense. And the fact we're even being pushed to do that at a $300 and $400 bike, is interesting. Cause again, I don't think that's something I had never considered that, to be honest. And that really was eye opening for me.
It's really true. And I think, what it also does is it shows a relationship between the people and the product that are at the more value conscious side of the spectrum and also the performance product, and that they influence each other. It's like you're buying not just a bike or a part, you're buying into a brand. And I think all of the big brands these days have that. You can see a BMC and know it's a BMC through and through. You can see a Trek and know it's a Trek, or even YT is a really good example from the direct-to-consumer market. Mm-hmm. Pretty much all the established brands right now have a distinct look and feel to their product, and that's really important for product messaging. You got to market these products and market your brand. And also, ultimately, it's what people expect nowadays. They don't just expect the product to function perfectly, but they expect it to be easy to maintain, easy to use, straightforward. And to look nice too. It's all the different things you would say look for in the next car you buy, but it's just a different product.
So what comes first then? Is it the engineering, kind of the fit, form and function of the bike or the part or whatever it happens to be, or is it the design to make sure that it looks like it's, you know, it's got the right silhouette, or it looks like it's part of that brand's product lineup?
Well, that's a good question.
Yeah, it's even upstream from that. It starts as a concept from typically, you know, it depends on the company, but either a product manager or someone in marketing, you know, however they're structured again. But it's like one way that I loved doing it is studying just out in the market, you know, I call it the market, but just out in life. Like, are there any modifications that people are making on their bikes that you can learn from? So I think gravel bikes is the most relevant at this point. There was a lot of people that had maybe an older road bike that they, you know, because maybe it was a little bit more durable, or if it did get broken, they were less concerned than breaking, you know, like a, you know, a $10,000 road bike if they took it off road. So they'd be modifying older bikes and maybe mounting bags to them, or just taking them out and riding them with fatter tires because there was still more clearance on some of these older frames. So that was kind of eye-opening. It's like, huh, what's going on here? Like, why are people doing this? And then you dig deeper into that. Fast forward to basically making a proposal to your team and to upper management of, hey, this is a new bike that we should look into. And here are all, like, here's some images that I've taken from, you know, traveling around or on the internet of how people are modifying the bikes. That gives an idea of like, okay, why are we doing this? Or why are you proposing this? And then you jump into details of like, if we were to do it, here's how I think, or here are the important things I think we should focus on. So maybe it's around, you know, could be around durability. So you need a road style frame that's more durable. It has bigger, you know, fatter tire clearance. It has tons of mounts on the frame, so you can mount bags and water bottles and whatever it may be. You know, you start chipping away at that. So you make this proposal, it's all on paper or on a PowerPoint presentation, whatever it may be. And then once you get that approval, that's within your team, you then take it to a wider audience if you have that. So that would be where your distributors come into play, and you say, hey guys, here's what I'm seeing. Here's what I think the vision is. What do you think? And you typically get a lot of pushback because, and again, this is a generalization. I'm not saying everyone's thinking this way, but what I would see a lot of times is people pushing back because they are so focused on what's selling today that they want more of it. And looking at something that's new, that's going to typically displace some other model that they're buying because not everyone has unlimited cash, right? Like, so if you're going to bring in model A that's new, it needs to replace model B that's been there for a while and not doing so hot. And that's tough to do sometimes because you may have a lot of models that are all doing well, and you're basically, as a product manager, you're asking them, hey, I need you to trust me on this to the point where you might lose money if I'm wrong. And that's scary, right? A lot of people don't want to get involved in that. So assume you can get sign off from all these different channels, then it jumps into, like you said, so that's where you would then work with someone like Adam first, because he's an industrial designer. Well, Adam, I'll let you explain that process, but I just wanted to say, like, it starts with sketches that then are work. Once those are approved, then you're working with engineering.
And just before we move on to Adam and the design side of things, how far are we from going to market at this point, like in a large company? A year, 2 years, like,
no, like 2 years. Scale? No, you're like 2 years out. So just for general, again, this is very generalization, but you're typically looking at around 18 months to develop a new bike. And that's from like engineering's ready to go start designing, because you have to get, you know, there's a lot of testing that goes into the frames and engineering revisions. And there's a lot of back and forth really with, well, we can get into that later, but the factory plays a gigantic role in making this happen, because there's design engineering and then there's production engineering, and they're different. As I mean, Chris, you know that firsthand. It's very, very different process.
Yeah, for sure. All right, Adam, talk us through a little bit then the kind of design side of things. Once this, I guess, brief has been approved within the business,
yeah, like, sure.
How do you pick it up and what do you do with it?
Well, it can be different with every project because you might have different product managers and different key stakeholders for each project. And even within an organization, each particular department, say performance road, active bikes, mountain bikes, they have maybe different factories they work with and different market leaders, et cetera, that they might talk to for advice on upcoming product portfolio. What you really need to get started is a clear understanding of what the bike is and how it's different from what came before it and what it will sell next to as well, both from the competition and in your own product line. And that all comes down to usually, depending on also on how the way the company works, but most of the time, some sort of product brief, which is basically a master document of all the research that has been done. And in general, the best practice is that the designers and the engineers had influence over that product brief, because ultimately they're the people that need to make the physical product. And that product brief is always acting like a kind of a North Star for the project to make sure that it doesn't go off course, and to give general guidelines of how to execute it. And really through that product brief, you should be able to understand, okay, where is the positioning? What feeling should the product have? What type of rider is using it? Is this someone that can bleed their own brakes, or is this someone who rides the bike with half inflated tires and always in the smallest ring because they're afraid to touch their shifter? You know, both those riders exist, and you need to just plan ahead really, and know what kind of features and benefits are most important and how the person will interact with the bike. And the styling part of it within each organization is also different, because if you think of, say, some auto manufacturers, by and large, you say go through from the BMW 3 Series, 5 Series, 7 Series, and all the other different things. It's kind of like that old analogy of like just cutting the sausage at different lengths to make different cars. And sometimes you're really doing that, right? You're just, okay, well, this was a 140 29er bike, and now it's a 150 650 bike. And they're really the same bike, just with different wheel sizes. And other times you're asked to generate, say, a new silhouette to usher in, say, a new line of bikes that are playing to a different rider or playing to a different feature set, which is the fun part of being a designer, right? That the goal is always a little bit different. And you face both when you work at a company for a long enough period of time. So sometimes I'm asked to come up with a bunch of different silhouettes, and other times it's really just we have the bones. Just we need to make sure that through the geo and through the kinematic and these couple different clearance models that everything checks out and nothing looks weird on the extra large or weird on the extra small. So it varies greatly.
And are you like, is there a tension between the design element and the way a product looks and then the engineering element and the way a product works?
No, so, never.
There shouldn't be. There really shouldn't be, because both are equally important for the end result of any good product, whether it is a nice espresso machine or a Tesla or a bike. Historically, yes, absolutely. And that really just comes down to everyone deep down has some level of ego that tells them that their job is more important than the others. And historically, in different professions, right, you have people that are in different roles and they're kind of pitted against each other. And so, of course, engineers are seen stereotypically as the realists that come in and say no to all the flamboyant, extravagant ideas of the designers that are just not grounded in reality. Well, the truth is that both people probably arrived at their careers because they have inherent interests and traits that brought them there. And of course, those interests and traits will manifest in the way they contribute. So I expect, yeah, of course I should get pushback at some point. If I'm not being creative enough, then I won't get pushback. So I need to push a little bit further than what I think, say, the forging maker can do, or the engineer is comfortable modeling or whatever, to get the most out of what's possible for the next generation. And at the same time, I'm also expecting that the engineer, with the hard points that they've delivered, the kinematic with the weight target and everything, has also tried to push as well. But then all these things come back, and this is where the product manager and developer are positioned within this team, is to say, okay, yeah, but if we can't make this quantity for production because half of them are failing testing, at that light weight, then we add the 1 mil of wall thickness to that tube to get it to pass testing for all the bikes, and we take the extra 100 grams. So all these different ways that the engineer or the designer want to push the project and influence the project need to be checked and reeled back. And ultimately, that's that brief, right? Because and if it's... go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say an example being like, okay, let's say with the frame design, let's say it's you create this very beautiful flowing aluminum, and it's supposed to be an aluminum frame, right? The engineer is going to look at it and be like, okay, so to make this happen, that means we're going to need a tremendous amount of hydroforming, and that's not cheap. And so that's going to add, you know, whatever, X percent or X dollars to the frame. And then if you guys aren't able to come up with a compromise, then they go to the product manager who then needs to make that call. Because they could argue, the product manager could argue, well, it's worth the additional cost because this thing's going to look awesome and we're going to gain additional sales from it. Or, yeah, no freaking way. Like, this is a $500 bike. Like, you need to go back to the drawing board. So I found that to be pretty interesting. And it's usually, I think that's where the most conflict comes from between an engineer and an industrial designer, is just kind of figuring out like, okay, well, here's what you want it to look like. Here's reality of how you actually make that happen. Are you okay living with that? Like, you're going to see a weld here where you want it to be a seamless transition between tubes or whatever it may be. Or like, hey, this curve's actually going to be a little bit lumpy because we have to do mechanical forming as opposed to hydroforming. Are you okay with that? And again, if you can't come to resolution, then that's usually where a product manager steps in and is like, okay, final decision is this. We're going forward with it.
Well, and a good example. Go ahead, Chris.
I was just going to say, so it's a really tight relationship then between the engineer and the industrial designer. I guess it has to be. Yeah.
It will either make friendships or break friendships. But a good example, Aaron, of what you were talking about and how it gets problem solved is, if you have an eager, you know, a hungry engineer and designer on a project, then with that exact example that Aaron gave, well, then they might sit their heads down and go, okay, the hydroformed tube, can we achieve 90% of the look just with mechanical bending? Or can we achieve the look without hydroforming if instead of using hydroforming tools, we just do two different mechanical tubes, one for extra small through medium, and then one for large through extra large. And then you can achieve kind of what you need without that expensive process. And these types of problem solving things come up a lot. And those things are where you see people kind of gaining a mastery of the skill, because bikes, as it comes to a lot of different things, are quite complicated on the scale of complexity.
And you're not taught that in school, right? Like, this was just all hands-on, like spending time in factories and with engineers, I assume?
Yeah, totally. And I don't think engineers are taught that in school either. That's just real life dealing with the realities of making something under constraints.
And this is where a really good relationship and communication with your factories and your suppliers is super important, right?
Yeah, 100%. So I mean, that's where the other part of the equation comes in, right? So you've done all this work, you've gotten buy off from your sales channels, and then your engineering team is supporting this project. So you've got some concepts, and you're ready to go. You now have a frame that is in CAD. So you hand it off to your factory. They're now going to review it with their engineering team. And the beautiful thing I always loved about this is, how do I say it? So the production engineering team is going to look at this in terms of how do we take whatever their design is and make this in a highly efficient and accurate manner. So what I mean by that is, like, are we able to pump out a ton of these without major issues where we're going to hold up the production line because of constantly having quality issues, right? So they have a whole other lens that they're looking at. And then there's also the price target. So you need to factor that in as well, which is provided to the factory of like, hey, we're trying to hit a whatever $100 price point for this frame, for, you know, our cost to you. Can we do that? So then they're looking at it as well. And that's where things can really, you know, if you don't have a so experienced engineering team or, you know, whatever it may be, that's where things can really get sideways because, oh my gosh, there's so many different clearances on a frame. There's crank clearance, there's bottom bracket widths, there's, you know, with suspension linkages, all the different linkages that have to clear while also maintaining, you know, torsional strength and all of these things. And under load, they have to be able to stay strong and all of this. So there's a lot of moving parts, and one little, you know, innovative design aesthetic change can totally screw up all of that. And so the factory's best interest is to side towards conservative, you know, manufacturing techniques that they're very comfortable with and know work well, and they're going to try to push you in that direction. So that's where an engineer then would help step in and be like, okay, I understand what you're saying, but what if we tried it this way? And then it's just a back and forth conversation. And that can honestly take, that potentially could take months to get ironed out. You know, assuming that they're able to start making some handmade prototypes and welding them together. But that process is pretty gnarly and very in depth. And that's where things can, quite honestly, can fall apart if not managed properly. Or the part where I've seen it, not firsthand, but have heard some horror stories is where you maybe have a product manager or like a director of engineering who is very heavy-handed, and they may push a project through anyway, even though the factory hasn't agreed with how they're going to do it. And guess what? Now you have you're opening the door for you know, a potential a recall, right? Like a recall in the market because you didn't listen to their guidance. And guess what? The frame didn't work well and it's cracking or whatever it may be. So, you know, it's an interesting give and take, and it's, again, there's a lot of layers involved.
Yeah, a lot. So what stages would a product go through then? So you've got your sign off and your approval. Mm-hmm. You've got this kind of brief that's gone to the, you know, the design and the engineering teams. From there, like, how do you, are there distinct phases that you move through? Like, I'm assuming that this thing's getting drawn in computer world first, like in some kind of computer aided design. And then how do you get from there to a final product?
So Aaron brought something up that made me think, okay, we need to touch on one more thing. And that is that many many bike companies as a whole have some sort of technical arm over in Asia. Specialized has multiple offices. Different companies have multiple offices over in Taiwan, Vietnam, China, wherever they're making their product. And there you generally find people native to that area, varying levels of English skills, but they're part of the core corporate team. And their job is to help execute the vision from whatever development center, wherever it is, as it is on the ground in the weeds, getting it really made. And they can obviously speak the language with the people really making it, go to factories regularly. All that stuff is huge. And those people are just as important as the people in the corporate office. And that also brings me to the CAD question that you have. And that is that this stuff, it can change hands many times because you may have, say there are project, there are frames that I did where I didn't do CAD, where I made a bunch of sketches, a bunch of really accurate side view renderings. I drew different cross sections with dimensions, shipped that over to probably at that point, our Taiwan development office. An engineer there took that stuff and interpreted it. And then we did different design reviews through and through many times to get it to look just right. And then we take a look at, say, the first frame I designed was the one of the specialized rock hoppers. Look at the whole size run. Oh, man, it looks really weird in this size. We need to problem solve that, which there's always a weird and ugly duckling. So and then from there, it gets translated also into 2D drawings, which are really important for the factories to hold tolerances. To understand the different tube thicknesses and different processes and finishes. And then obviously there's factories cut tools and make a product. But on the performance side, carbon, there you may have, I may do a quote unquote ID CAD model, which the engineers think is a whole bunch of crap. So then they redo it. And generally also they look at CAD with a different skill set, and they're going to interpret each feature that I've made in a way that is usually more sound for engineering practices and minimum radii and all that stuff. And then that goes over to the vendor, and whether or not the vendor uses that CAD is up to them. Sometimes there's another level of CAD that's done. Hopefully the CAD that was created by the engineers goes over and is used to actually cut the surfaces of the mold, so the design integrity comes through. But we're talking about the development cycle, and when it comes to performance carbon product, you want to buy the one that took 4 years to make. You know, you want to buy the one that took a while to come to market, because that meant that they were ambitious enough with the targets that they failed. And that means they actually made it lighter, or they made it stiffer, or they made it better. By and large, carbon's gotten on the cheaper end, has gotten a lot better over the years. But a lot of times what we were seeing, say 5 or 6 years ago, is the cheap carbon frames out there were not any better than good alloy frame, because they just threw a whole bunch of carbon and fiberglass at it, so it passed testing. And generally the properties that came out of it were kind of guesswork. It's like, okay, it's safe, it can't kill you, it's good, it goes out. I'm not saying that's what I dealt with at any of the places I've worked, but there were a lot of frames out there, especially from some of the cheaper brands offering carbon stuff. And then you look at something like, say, the Tarmac I have, where each size, the layup was scrutinized over and over again to get the properties just right. And the fork layup is specific to the size and everything. And then it's like, okay, they used the material to hit the properties, and they failed each bike to make sure it's as light as it can be, and really pushed it. And that's like a good sign of a good performance product.
And man, in order for that to happen, you have to have a huge budget, right? So like, yes, it's not a level playing field when you're developing anything. Like we were talking about before this, it's no different than what Formula One's dealing with, where you have, you know, Red Bull and Ferrari and Mercedes with these massive budgets competing against, you know, everyone else who has a much smaller budget and a smaller team and less resources to make things happen. And, you know, as a result, the performance is different. Again, like it's really competitive out there, and it's amazing what we're able to do with carbon frames these days, but, optimizing layup per size. I mean, that's not something you just do. Like that takes a very dedicated team who's set up to accommodate that. And who has the luxury of time and resources to invest in that, right? Like that's not something a small brand's going to ever be able to afford. So it's interesting. It that definitely changes the dynamic of what we're talking about, because it's not apples to apples by any means.
Well, maybe that's why a lot of the smaller brands are working in metal rather than carbon.
That's very
sure. I mean, and there's so much cool stuff you can do with alloy. I mean, we started to look into it right before actually I was leaving at Specialized. There's some there's a lot that can still be done with alloy that we really haven't. We've just barely scratched the surface of. And it's just going to take a brand to really own it and go all in and really commit to it and make it happen. Cause we were finding some really incredible stuff that we actually didn't bring to market, but it's close. It's super close. So yeah, that's a good point, Chris. I mean, it makes me wonder too, especially with wheels on a mountain bike, especially like a carbon wheel, I stay away from just cause there's really incredible, even lighter weight alloy wheels that I don't mind the ride feel of whatsoever, you know? So it's, anyway, it's just one of those things.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the number of iterations you might go through to get to a finished product. So you've designed, you've worked with your engineering team, they're happy with it. You've worked with your production engineers, and we're happy that we can make it. Is that it then? It's done? You just order them and they turn up? What happens between being happy with the design everyone's bought in to actually saying, yeah, this is good to go?
yeah, that depends, right? It's how complex of an undertaking are you doing? Man, even on simple stuff, you still blow it. Like there's still mistakes where you're just like, God damn, how is this not passing testing? Are you kidding me? Like this is a simple frame. We've done it a million times. But again, because there's all these moving parts, one little geo change here, oh wow, that amplifies the stresses on the head tube like I was not even expecting. You know, there's a lot of that. So I don't know. It unfortunately the answer is it varies, but Adam, what do you think, man? I mean, anywhere from one and done is pretty rare, no matter what you're doing, unless you aren't taking any risk. But man, it can be what, 20 revisions? It depends.
So there's a lot. And kind of like what I said before, there almost should be a lot, right? Because if you want to optimize the product, you gotta, like I said, fail it a couple times or go out on a limb and try something and it can't be achieved or what have you. But it also depends on the atmosphere at the company. Was the product manager or the director or whoever really secure in their idea when we started, or in having finally seen the product start to take shape? Now there are questions and it's, oh, you know what? We really need to change the geo. We need 10 more miles of travel. Or, oh, you know what? We want to change the cable routing to allow for this configuration or something. All these things can happen. And sometimes it can just come from the different, hindsight's always 20/20, right? And at some point you have to weigh the possible delays that the project takes versus the pluses that the end product would have because of those delays. And also you're working with outside suppliers, and sometimes they set out to do something that everyone feels comfortable should be achievable, and then it's not achievable. And you only find that out once you get into real materials and once you've paid for tooling and what have you. And now everyone's kind of sitting there twiddling their thumbs. Oh, well, now we need to problem solve this rocker link, or now the BB is just not working out. We need to retool it. That happens. That's totally just a part of making a cutting edge product. And the other funny thing, Aaron, that I don't know if you dealt with it at Specialized, but color and graphics, that can make a bike fail testing. So, anodizing, matte finish, raw finish, sanding and smoothing out welds, two-tone anodizing, all these different things have a physical effect on the frame. And you might have a frame that when it's gloss, simple colors and all, it passes testing, and then you go to anodize it and or something crazy and now it fails. And
that's actually we had one. We just sandblasted the surface finish of the alloy tubes, as a complete bike, and that dramatically increased strength. Because what you're doing is, like, let's say there's some little imperfection on a very smooth tube, that imperfection can turn into a crack, and when you sandblast it, it basically resets at the surface of the tubing. That one was fascinating. That to me, I was just like, what? That tiny little change made a dramatic impact on our testing results. And we were able to actually reduce wall thickness on a few tubes and make the frame lighter just by sandblasting the tubing.
That's literally just by shooting sand at the frame at a high velocity to create that like matte pop.
Exactly. Yeah, it makes the surface finish a little bit matte. But then when you go to paint it, the paint's going to fill in all those little ripples, and it's going to look smooth. So you'd never know. It's just that those are the kind of things behind the scenes that a factory might recommend that you're like, oh, dude, that's a game changer. Yeah, let's do it.
The other funny thing is riv nuts. So let's say you want to move a water bottle up or down on the down tube for clearance. Well, what happens when you re-drill those holes in a different butting profile of the down tube? And that affects, obviously, the stress risers and if it can pass or fail. Or deciding to add or remove them. Anything that you do like that requires that the bike is retested. And like you said, how many revisions? Well, that's another revision. If you just move the one drilling operation up 10 millimeters, it's a new revision of the frame. So
you have to retest.
And how much of that testing these days is done physically versus simulation in computer world
at that point? Oh, like in the development, it's all physical. If you have physical objects, it's physical testing. The FEA is how you get close, and how you say test your aerodynamic principles or test your stiffness principles, your new frame silhouette, etc. It can be accurate when the right people do it with the right machines and stuff, but physical testing is ultimately the most important, because it respects the revision of the project after all of the processes that ultimately handle that product before it goes to the consumer.
Well, and I guess we should lay out what physical testing means. So Chris, you're talking about like ride samples where you're actually out riding and testing the frame, or are you talking about physical samples being tested on a machine?
Well, I guess, yeah, it breaks into both, doesn't it? On a fixture or a jig versus out riding with aggressive riders or whatever you think the worst case for that product is.
Totally. And starting with FEA, so I don't know what FEA even stands for, but it's basically it's modeling.
Finite element analysis.
Analysis, there you go. So being able to, so the problem with FEA though is you have to calibrate the FEA to do what you want it to, right? And so if you forget, well not forget, but like if there's a factor that you don't calibrate for, then it's totally inaccurate, which we found out through a project where we're like, oh man, this thing's going to, pass with flying colors. And then we get the results back and, it got nowhere close to passing testing. We're like, what the hell happened? And then sure enough, honestly, it took months to really fine tune the FEA analysis software. It turned out that, I don't remember exactly what it was, but there was some sort of factor that was not bumped up enough to what real life was actually like. And that's the crazy thing is you need someone who's a total expert in all of this stuff to even set up your software in the first place to kind of get ahead of making a physical sample and testing it. But the problem with bench testing, we call it, is you put it into a fixture and this machine is going to do something to the frame, like whether it's a hydraulic arm that's gripping the rear axle and pulling it up and down while the suspension's locked out 100,000 times. That's going to get you pretty close to real life. But the problem with real life is it's far more dynamic, right? So like the bike might be under load, you've bottomed out while you're turning and you're popping out of the corner into a jump. Like that, how the hell do you simulate that in a lab? Like it's impossible. So that's where you pass all this testing and then you get ride samples into your most abusive either team members or, both professional athletes as well as just, folks you work with in the office who might be really good at riding. That's where you really need to rely on them and they need to just beat the hell out of the frame because you're still going to find things that wasn't found in FEA, wasn't found in the lab. It just was found in real life situations. And unfortunately, you're typically under the clock at that point where you're like, all right, guys, this has taken 18 months now and you're just now getting a ride sample. Like, you need to hurry up. Like, we've already got sales committed to this frame that's not even done yet. Like, you need to hurry the hell up. And that's where I think if not properly managed, that's where you start to see, again, opportunities for warranty claims and just weird stuff is the business case outweighs, the potential risk of a small crack or something.
Yeah.
And I don't want to make it like it's not negligent behavior. It's just that's just unfortunately how things happen, you know?
Yeah. I was going to say, how do you know when it's done, when it's ready to launch? But like you say, maybe it is a calculated balance. You're never fully ready, are you?
I don't know a single person who would knowingly put something that was cracking into the market. That's not all what I'm saying. But what can happen is you haven't done thorough enough, I guess you could call it homework. You just haven't gone deep enough with your testing, or maybe you don't have access to a rider who will put this thing under the abuses of someone who weighs, 200 pounds and rides really hard. That's where you're just, again, you're at a disadvantage. These larger companies have a giant pool of people with a reputation, and a smaller brand may or may not have access to that. So you may not have, a Richie Rude at your disposal to test your frames for you, right? Like that guy is he's an incredible rider. And from what I've heard, he's a great test case, because he's able to really put frames through their absolute maximum, stresses, if that makes sense. So that's where, a small brand, like if Adam and I were like, hey, we're going to start a bike brand, like we don't have access to that. So it's going to be, a little more scary for us to put something confidently into the market. Cause like, I'm 150 pounds. I'm not going, I just don't ride at that level where I'm going to be able to come up with much, in terms of breaking something.
And so when things do go wrong, what do brands normally do about it? What's the reaction like?
So it depends how it's structured. So like a large company where you have a full, almost independently functioning service team, you as a product manager, to be totally honest, like you're not really feeling the full weight of that. You're being told, hey, dummy, your frame is causing all these problems. Like go figure it out with the factory. And obviously like your job depends on you doing that well. But at the same time, you're not the one that's dealing with customers who are just livid, or a dealer who's losing faith in your brand as a whole because of one frame that didn't go well. And that weight being on your shoulders and figuring out how you deal with that. Like that's a lot. That's a big weight. So typically what happens is, you know, somehow the issues are reported. It's on the customer service team to identify whether this is a one-off issue or a trend. And so typically there's some sort of baseline given to that team of like, okay, if this has happened with five frames within a 1 month period, boom, like we need to jump on this ASAP. This is a problem. If you see a head tube crack one time ever over like a 6 month period, is, you know, obviously you should report that to the team, but that could just be a one-off quality problem that you need to address with your factory. Let them know that's not okay. But like, you don't necessarily need to be like jumping on a plane and flying over there to go see what's going on. So it really depends. And, you know, I don't have like a specific guideline, but that's generally how it works. And then a smaller company, that issue would be reported probably to your sales team because they're the frontline working with customers and dealers. And then they're going to come to you and say, hey, this frame cracked. What do you think? And then it's on you to decide whether this is a trend or not. And then you work it out with your engineering team and your factory. But yeah, I mean, if it's a recall, I haven't personally had anything that went through recall, but I've been at a company where when a recall happened. And yeah, I mean, there's a whole legal process you have to follow with the CPSC here, at least. It's basically the Consumer Protection Bureau. So they have a very stringent set of rules of like how you can handle this, how you're communicating it to customers, how quick you have to react. And then what the basically like what are the retributions? Like, are you giving all customers a brand new frame? Do you need to get all of these off the street immediately? Or is this more of a like, hey, just so you know, there is an issue and it's up to you to act on it or not. So it depends on how dangerous it is. I don't know if you remember that a few years ago, there was a lawsuit actually where a big brand had a bike that had quick releases, I think is what it was. But basically like the disc brakes on these like commute bikes were causing so much torque when you're hitting the brakes that the forks were cracking. And it was a big finger pointing game of, was it the fork manufacturer's fault? Was this the, you know, hub manufacturer's fault? Was this, you know, was this the brake manufacturer's fault? Or was it the frame manufacturer for allowing this to happen in the first place? So things can get pretty ugly, but these days with how much technology there is and how much just tribal knowledge there is with engineering, like it's very rare to see an issue get that big these days.
Yeah, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
So we're getting close to the end of our time, but have you got much on the go with new PNW products that you're able to talk about, or is it all still secret?
Yeah, I mean, we have a ton of stuff coming, man. I'm really excited about it. So Adam's first projects will be hitting the market, I'd say probably June, July timeframe. But yeah, I mean, we've got a whole new line, you know, family of cockpit components. So higher end stuff. So this will be handlebar, stem, grip, seat, dropper seat post. We have a new pedal coming, a flat pedal. So that's been a really fun one because there's so many ways to go about this. There's, you know, do we extrude this design? Do we forge it? Do we do CNC? What type of bearing system do we want? What type of axle system and, you know, thicknesses, all of these things. So that's been fun figuring out what is our distinct point of view. So that'll be coming later this summer. We have some more fun type of items. You know, we've got the shifty lever, which is basically a loam lever, which is our dropper remote. But it fits onto, it replaces the shifter arm for a SRAM X01 and XX1 shifter. So that's, you know, I'm not going to sit here and claim there's massive performance benefits. It's a fun item. It does get you the little silicone pad and the thumb pad, and you're able to color match your whole bike. So I'm stoked about that. Nice. But yeah, we're also doing some, you know, we're creating a tool that is able to actually store on the bike. So we're both big proponents of optimizing storage on the bike. So we have a lot of concepts around that we're going to be bringing out this year too.
You got a busy year ahead then.
Yeah, it's been busy.
I don't know. I don't know why we do this to ourselves, but yeah, it's, there's a lot going on.
Good stuff. Yeah, well, we've got our questions that we normally end the podcast with, and Aaron, you've answered those before, but Adam hasn't, and there's actually one new one, so we can ask you that as well, Aaron. But
cool.
Adam, we'll hit these for you first. Okay. And the first one of those is, if our listeners had £150, so a couple of hundred euros to spend to improve their performance on a bike, what would you recommend they go and spend it on?
I would break it into two different categories. One is spend it on cross training, whether it's some sort of cross training gym membership or equipment or whatever, to build core and shoulder and just overall stability exercises that build your muscles. Cyclists and runners, if we just do one thing, we end up having a lot of deficiencies in our body that really, really do affect your ability to control your bike over long descents, to be happy and healthy on your bike over multiple days of riding. And that's huge. I'm also a product guy. So if I had to say product, I would say tires. A good set of tubeless tires for your gravel bike or mountain bike, or a good set of, you know, really nice high TPI tires for your road bike. And if it's a road bike, ultralight tubes, that is the best way to increase the performance of your bike. And also making sure that you're not just buying quote unquote the best tire, but that it's the right tire for the type of riding you actually do. And not just the type of riding that the guys on the pink bike videos do, because that is also generally what happens is people want to buy these big enduro bike with these crazy, crazy big 2.6 29 tires, and they ride more mellow stuff, and it sucks the fun out of it for them. So making sure that those £150 are spent on a really good tire setup that is appropriate for the type of riding you enjoy and the place that you enjoy it.
Good answer. I like it. Second question, if you could wind back the clock and sit down with yourself age 16, what advice would you give him?
Ooh, I would say crashing doesn't hurt as much as you think it will.
It does sometimes.
It can, but I was really timid at that age, and I think it held me back for several years. Okay. And, you know, a little bit of blood comes with the territory, I guess.
Yeah.
And I would also say to know that your particular discipline, which mine was designed at the time, will never save the world. That it will always be a team effort to make any good product happen.
Nice. All right. Third question. If you could have a coaching session with anyone, who would it be and what would you want to learn from them?
Oh, that's a good question. It would probably be someone like Bill Gates. And the reason I say that is because he not only changed the way that the consumer industry is shaped and revolutionized the digital world, but he's someone that did it and now is using the gifts from that to change the world for the better. And I would want to hear his perspective on how he found insights and breakthroughs and why he spends so much of his effort and his money, honestly, doing the things that he does now, which I think are unbelievable.
Yeah, it's impressive stuff to be sure. Yeah, yeah. All right. And then the final question, what is something you do every day that you feel benefits you? And this one's coming your way as well, Aaron, so get thinking.
Something I do every day that benefits me is definitely laughing. My wife is Swiss, and she has stereotypically a very much more straightforward sense of humor, and I'm kind of an absurdist. And I think laughing, finding funny stuff to laugh about, it both boosts my creativity and lowers my stress levels, but it keeps things in perspective. And, you know, the bike industry, working in the bike industry, people always say, like, don't let it burn you out of your passion. And, you know, it can do that if you don't watch out. And laughing is a good way to keep life in perspective. So that's my vote.
Do you save up all the things that you want to joke about for when I wake up and
for like a
3-hour window?
Yeah. And then you're like, it's 6:30 in the morning.
What are you talking about?
And I'm sending him like memes or like rap songs.
Nice. I like it. A little window into your relationship.
Oh yeah, for sure.
You do every day that you feel fishy.
For sure. Using my hands. That's a huge part for like unlocking the other part of my brain that really, really needs to be used. Right. So a lot of what we do is very, it's all on the computer, right. Or talking on the phone, but like, I'm a very like kinesthetic learner. And so for instance, being able to cook is huge for me. It's extremely therapeutic and relaxing. And then also obviously the benefit of I'm controlling what's going into my body in terms of the health benefits, but yeah, using my hands, man, is big. So whether it's cooking or like yesterday I took a lawnmower apart because it wasn't working and inspected the engine and it turned out there was a little water in there and that the choke design was stupid. So I just removed the choke altogether. And now it's working great. So I even though it's such a small thing, man, I had so much fun doing it. So that's big for me.
Interesting. Cool. Yeah. Like it. And Adam, a bit of advice from you then. If people are listening to this and they want to get into the bike industry and specifically into the design side of things, any advice that you would give people, whether they're young or old, I guess?
Yes, absolutely. One, pay attention to other riders. You find your riding crew and generally it's other people that are like-minded and do the same type of riding that you do. You find a shop that you're loyal to, et cetera. Keep your eyes peeled for other groups of riders, other types of riders, other types of riding, and try and see the hobby as a whole. And the second one is to ranch on your bikes. And, honestly, one of the biggest things that we had trouble with, in pretty much every round of hiring I was ever involved in, is finding designers who not only like bikes, but understand bikes. And, ultimately, just because, one designer makes all these unbelievably beautiful sketches doesn't mean that when they're given a real project, they can actually make something real happen. And, so speaking to the design side of things, understanding your practical knowledge and how the bike works is going to be a huge leg up.
Very good advice. Yeah, definitely agree with that. Cool. Well, if people want to find out a little bit more about PNW and keep an eye on what you guys are up to with all these new products you've got coming out, where's the best place for them to head?
The best place is to sign up for our email list. We do not spam people. We really do stick to like only going to send out things that we would want to receive. So that's product announcements typically. Check out our website, pnwcomponents.com. And you're able to sign up for the email list. Actually, if you just scroll down to the bottom, it's down on the right side. So that's what I suggest. And, follow us on Instagram. It's just pnwcomponents. We're very active on there and have a very, we try to keep things pretty light and have fun with it. So you see some pretty goofy stuff on there.
Your April Fools, by the way. That was
No, I can't take credit for that one, but man, they did a great job. That was pretty damn funny.
I'll put a link to all of those sensible links and also to your April Fools video in the show notes.
Cool.
So people can have a look at that because it's worth a watch.
Awesome, man. I appreciate that.
Good stuff. Well, thanks a lot for your time today, chaps. It's been super interesting chatting. And I hope you have another strong year and see a lot of growth and loads of new products with people out there enjoying them on the trails.
Hey, same to you, man. I really appreciate the continued support. And I've been loving the show, man.
Nice one. Thanks, man.
Yeah.
This has been a great experience. Right. Thank you very much for having us.
Good stuff. Take care. Have a good evening.
Yeah.
You too.
All right, that's it for this episode with Aaron and Adam. I hope you've enjoyed listening. A massive thanks to PNW Components for supporting this episode. Don't forget to head to pnwcomponents.com and check out their awesome range and make the most of being a downtime listener by using the code PNWDOWNTIME at the checkout for 15% off during May. That's PNWDOWNTIME, all one word, all lowercase. All the links are in the show notes for this episode over on downtimepodcast.com. If you've got a couple of spare minutes, then please leave us a review wherever it is you listen to the podcast. Give us a follow on social media, where you'll find us by looking for @downtimepodcast. Subscribe to the show so you get all our episodes delivered straight to your device. And if you want to help support the podcast, then you can share the love at downtimepodcast.com/shop. Keep on spreading the word, telling your friends about the podcast, and sharing our episodes on your social media. Don't forget to check out Downtime Live too, where you can watch all of our previous live episodes and set a reminder for our upcoming episode with Chris Kilmurray at youtube.com/downtime mountain bike podcast. All right, we've got another awesome episode coming up soon, but until then, look after each other, and if it's okay to do so, then get out and ride safely.